Chapter 39. When he felt the solid ground of the courtyard under his feet, Willems pulled himself up in his headlong rush, and moved forward with a moderate gait. He paced stiffly, looking with extreme exactitude at Lingard's face, looking neither to the right nor to the left, but at the face only, as if there was nothing in the world but those features familiar and dreaded, that white-haired, rough and severe head upon which he gazed in a fixed effort of his eyes, like a man trying to read small print at the full range of human vision. As soon as Willem's feet had left the planks, the silence which had been lifted up by the jerky rattle of his footsteps fell down again upon the courtyard. The silence of the cloudy sky, and of the windless air, the sullen silence of the earth oppressed by the aspect of coming turmoil, the silence of the world collecting its faculties to withstand the storm. Through this silence Willems pushed his way, and stopped about 6 feet from Lingard. He stopped simply because he could go no further. He had started from the door with the reckless purpose of clapping the old fellow on the shoulder. He had no idea that the man would turn out to be so tall, so big and so unapproachable. It seemed to him that he had never, never in his life, seen Lingard. He tried to say, "Do not believe." A fit of coughing checked his sentence in a faint splutter. Directly afterwards he swallowed as it were a couple of pebbles, throwing his chin up in the act. And Lingard, who looked at him narrowly, saw a bone, sharp and triangular like the head of a snake, dart up and down twice under the skin of his throat. Then that too did not move. Nothing moved. "Well," said Lingard, and with that word he came unexpectedly to the end of his speech. His hand in his pocket closed firmly round the butt of his revolver, bulging his jacket on the hip, and he thought how soon, and how quickly he could terminate his quarrel with that man who had been so anxious to deliver himself into his hands, and how inadequate would be that ending. He could not bear the idea of that man escaping from him by going out of life, escaping from fear, from doubt, from remorse into the peaceful certitude of death. He held him now. And he was not going to let him go, to let him disappear forever in the faint blue smoke of a pistol shot. His anger grew within him. He felt a touch, as of a burning hand on his heart. Not on the flesh of his breast, but a touch on his heart itself, on the palpitating and untiring particle of matter that responds to every emotion of the soul, that leaps with joy, with terror, or with anger. He drew a long breath. He could see before him the bare chest of the man expanding and collapsing under the wide-open jacket. He glanced aside, and saw the bosom of the woman near him rise and fall in quick respirations, that moved slightly up and down her hand, which was pressed to her breast with all the fingers spread out and a little curved, as if grasping something too big for its span. And nearly a minute passed. One of those minutes, when the voice is silenced, while the thoughts flutter in the head, like captive birds inside a cage, in rushes desperate, exhausting and vain. During that minute of silence Lingard's anger kept rising, immense and towering, such as a crested wave running over the troubled shallows of the sands. Its roar filled his cars, a roar so powerful and distracting that, it seemed to him, his head must burst directly with the expanding volume of that sound. He looked at that man. That infamous figure upright on its feet, still, rigid, with stony eyes, as if its rotten soul had departed that moment, and the carcass hadn't had the time yet to topple over. For the fraction of a second he had the illusion, and the fear of the scoundrel, having died there before the enraged glance of his eyes. Willem's eyelids fluttered, and the unconscious and passing tremor in that stiffly erect body exasperated Lingard like a fresh outrage. The fellow dared to stir, dared to wink, to breathe, to exist, here, right before his eyes. His grip on the revolver relaxed gradually. As the transport of his rage increased, so also his contempt for the instruments, that pierce or stab, that interpose themselves between the hand and the object of hate. He wanted another kind of satisfaction. Naked hands, by heaven! No firearms. hands that could take him by the throat, beat down his defense, batter his face into shapeless flesh, hands that could feel all the desperation of his resistance, and overpower it in the violent delight of a contact lingering and furious, intimate and brutal. He let go the revolver altogether, stood hesitating, then throwing his hands out, strode forward and everything passed from his sight. He could not see the man, the woman, the earth, the sky, saw nothing, as if in that one stride he had left the visible world behind to step into a black and deserted space. He heard screams round him in that obscurity, screams like the melancholy and pitiful cries of seabirds that dwell on the lonely reefs of great oceans. Then suddenly a face appeared within a few inches of his own. His face. He felt something in his left hand. His throat. Da da da. The thing like a snake's head that darts up and down. Da da. He squeezed hard. He was back in the world. He could see the quick beating of eyelids over a pair of eyes that were all whites, the grin of a drawn-up lip, a row of teeth gleaming through the drooping hair of a mustache. Dot dot. Strong white teeth. Knock them down his lying throat. Dot dot dot. He drew back his right hand, the fist up to the shoulder, knuckles out. From under his feet rose the screams of seabirds. Thousands of them. Something held his legs. Dot dot. What the devil. Dot dot dot. He delivered his blow straight from the shoulder, felt the jar right up his arm, and realized suddenly that he was striking something passive and unresisting. His heart sank within him with disappointment, with rage, with mortification. He pushed with his left arm, opening the hand with haste, as if he had just perceived that he got hold by accident of something repulsive, and he watched with stupefied eyes Willems tottering backwards in groping strides, the white sleeve of his jacket across his face. He watched his distance from that man increase, while he remained motionless, without being able to account to himself for the fact that so much empty space had come in between them. It should have been the other way. They ought to have been very close, and dot 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 ah. He wouldn't fight, he wouldn't resist, he wouldn't defend himself. A cur. Evidently a cur. Dot dot. He was amazed and aggrieved profoundly, bitterly, with the immense and blank desolation of a small child robbed of a toy. He shouted unbelieving. Will you be a cheat to the end? He waited for some answer. He waited anxiously with an impatience that seemed to lift him off his feet. He waited for some word, some sign, for some threatening stir. Nothing. Only two unwinking eyes glittered intently at him above the white sleeve. He saw the raised arm detach itself from the face and sink along the body. A white-clad arm, with a big stain on the white sleeve. A red stain. There was a cut on the cheek. It bled. The nose bled too. The blood ran down, made one mustache look like a dark rag stuck over the lip, and went on in a wet streak down the clipped beard on one side of the chin. A drop of blood hung on the end of some hairs that were glued together. It hung for a while, and took a leap down on the ground. Many more followed, leaping one after another in close file. One alighted on the breast and glided down instantly with devious vivacity, like a small insect running away. It left a narrow dark track on the white skin. He looked at it, looked at the tiny and active drops, looked at what he had done, with obscure satisfaction, with anger, with regret. This wasn't much like an act of justice. He had a desire to go up nearer to the man, to hear him speak, to hear him say something atrocious and wicked that would justify the violence of the blow. He made an attempt to move, and became aware of a close embrace round both his legs, just above the ankles. Instinctively, he kicked out with his foot, broke through the close bond and felt at once the clasp transferred to his other leg, the clasp warm, desperate and soft, of human arms. He looked down bewildered. He saw the body of the woman stretched at length, flattened on the ground like a dark blue rag. She trailed face downwards, clinging to his leg with both arms, in a tenacious hug. He saw the top of her head, the long black hair streaming over his foot, all over the beaten earth, around his boot. He couldn't see his foot for it. He heard the short and repeated moaning of her breath. He imagined the invisible face close to his heel. With one kick into that face he could free himself. He dared not stir, and shouted down, "Let go! Let go! Let go!" The only result of his shouting was a tightening of the pressure of her arms. With a tremendous effort he tried to bring his right foot up to his left, and succeeded partly. He heard distinctly the rub of her body on the ground as he jerked her along. He tried to disengage himself by drawing up his foot. He stamped. He heard a voice saying sharply, "Steady, Captain Lingard, steady." His eyes flew back to Willems at the sound of that voice, and, in the quick awakening of sleeping memories, Lingard stood suddenly still, appeased by the clear ring of familiar words. Appeased as in days of old, when they were trading together, when Willems was his trusted and helpful companion in out-of-the-way and dangerous places, when that fellow, who could keep his temper so much better than he could himself, had spared him many a difficulty, had saved him from many an act of hasty violence by the timely and good-humored warning, whispered or shouted, "Steady, Captain Lingard, steady." A smart fellow. He had brought him up. The smartest fellow in the islands. If he had only stayed with him, then all this. Dot dot, he called out to Willems, "Tell her to let me go or..." Dot, he heard Willems shouting something, waited for a while, then glanced vaguely down and saw the woman still stretched out perfectly mute and unstirring, with her head at his feet. He felt a nervous impatience that, somehow, resembled fear. "Tell her to let go, to go away, Willems, I tell you. I've had enough of this," he cried. "All right, Captain Lingard," answered the calm voice of Willems, as he has let go. "Take your foot off her hair, she can't get up." Lingard leaped aside, clean away, and spun round quickly. He saw her sit up and cover her face with both hands, then he turned slowly on his heel and looked at the man. Willems held himself very straight, but was unsteady on his feet, and moved about nearly on the same spot, like a tipsy man attempting to preserve his balance. After gazing at him for a while, Lingard called, rancorous and irritable, "What have you got to say for yourself?" Willems began to walk towards him. He walked slowly, reeling a little, before he took each step, and Lingard saw him put his hand to his face, then look at it holding it up to his eyes, as if he had there, concealed in the hollow of the palm, some small object which he wanted to examine secretly. Suddenly he drew it, with a brusque movement, down the front of his jacket and left a long smudge. "That's a fine thing to do," said Willems. He stood in front of Lingard, one of his eyes sunk deep in the increasing swelling of his cheek, still repeating mechanically the movement of feeling his damaged face. And every time he did this, he pressed the palm to some clean spot on his jacket, covering the white cotton with bloody imprints, as of some deformed and monstrous hand. Lingard said nothing, looking on. At last Willems left off staunching the blood and stood, his arms hanging by his side, with his face stiff and distorted under the patches of coagulated blood, and he seemed as though he had been set up there for a warning. An incomprehensible figure marked all over with some awful and symbolic signs of deadly import. Speaking with difficulty, he repeated in a reproachful tone, "That was a fine thing to do." "After all," answered Lingard, bitterly, "I had too good an opinion of you. And I of you. Don't you see that I could have had that fool over there killed, and the whole thing burned to the ground, swept off the face of the earth? You wouldn't have found as much as a heap of ashes had I liked. I could have done all that. And I wouldn't. You could not. You dared not. You scoundrel!" cried Lingard. "What's the use of calling me names?" "True," retorted Lingard, "here's no name bad enough for you." There was a short interval of silence. At the sound of their rapidly exchanged words, Asa had got up from the ground, whereas he had been sitting, in a sorrowful and dejected pose, and approached the two men. She stood on one side and looked on eagerly, in a desperate effort of her brain, with the quick and distracted eyes of a person trying for her life, to penetrate the meaning of sentences uttered in a foreign tongue. The meaning portentous and fateful that lurks in the sounds of mysterious words, in the sounds surprising, unknown and strange. Willems let the last speech of Lingard pass by, seemed by a slight movement of his hand, to help it on its way, to join the other shadows of the past. Then he said, "You have struck me, you have insulted me." "Dot insulted you?" interrupted Lingard, passionately. "Oh, what can insult you? Dot you dot," he choked, advanced a step. "Steady, steady," said Willems calmly. "Tell you I shan't fight. Is it clear enough to you that I shan't? I shall not lift a finger." As he spoke, slowly punctuating each word with a slight jerk of his head, he stared at Lingard, his right eye open and big, the left small, and nearly closed by the swelling of one half of his face, that appeared all drawn out on one side like faces seen in a concave glass. And they stood exactly opposite each other. One tall, slight and disfigured, the other tall, heavy, and severe. Willems went on, "If I had wanted to hurt you, if I had wanted to destroy you, it was easy. I stood in the doorway long enough to pull a trigger, and you know I shoot straight." "You would have missed," said Lingard, with assurance. "Here is, under heaven, such a thing as justice." The sound of that word on his own lips made him pause, confused, like an unexpected and unanswerable rebuke. The anger of his outraged pride, the anger of his outraged heart, had gone out in the blow, and there remained nothing but the sense of some immense infamy, of something vague, disgusting and terrible, which seemed to surround him on all sides, hover about him with shadowy and stealthy movements, like a band of assassins in the darkness of vast and unsafe places. Was there, under heaven, such a thing as justice? He looked at the man before him with such an intensity of prolonged glance, that he seemed to see right through him, that at last he saw but a floating and unsteady mist in human shape. Would it blow away before the first breath of Gutenberg edition? End of chapter.